Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. We're in New York today. We're doing one on-site. We're joined by Ignacio Berardi, the co-founder and CEO of Rexy. And we're talking about rebuilding the foundation of financial operations, FinOps. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you. And by way of introduction, Ignacio and the team have built Rexy, which is an AI-native financial ops platform. They help fintechs, neobanks, and payment companies, something we're pretty familiar with. We worked with Wise and Gray and lots of those folks. They help them automate reconciliation, accelerate their financial close, and replace fragile manual back office workflows with intelligent agentic systems. Does that sound about right?
Exactly.
Okay. Ignacio brings a rare combination of strategy, products, and operational depth to his role. He cut his teeth at Bain, which is a small outfit you might have heard of, and he advised financial services companies across Latin America before moving into fintech at Bitso, one of the region's leading crypto exchanges. And he also ran payments and Web3 products there. It was there in the trenches of the real money movement that he discovered the problem that Rexy was built to solve, which we'll talk about in a second. I completed his MBA at Harvard Business School, another small outfit you might have heard of. And then he launched Rexy and has been seen building what he describes as the operating system, the OS, for modern finance. Anyway, just had a shout out HBS there. Sponsor us, HBS, if you'd like. So let's dig in. First question, we like to talk and have our guests describe the landscape. So tell us about, you know, what is broken in the FinOps and the financial operations stack, and why has no one fixed it? Really broad, easy question to start.
I think it's one of those things that slowly we're going in a trend where it's a problem. It's something that will become a problem somewhere in the future. So as we build towards that, no one's actually taking care of it and taking it seriously. And there's a specific point in time where it breaks and suddenly everyone realizes, okay, now we need to stop and do stuff in a more sustainable manner. I think probably saying it's broken, it's a bit too hard on it. It's basically the application layer has evolved very quickly.
Yep.
And the infrastructure below has not kept up.
So if you can, like, just kind of paint the picture for our audience, like, walk us through a typical day for kind of a finance or ops team. You know, say they're at a fast-growing fintech. You know, you talked about how 95% of the transactions are pretty straightforward, but that other 5% drive the majority of the cost and the risk. So talk us through those 5% of problems that those teams are facing. What are they? What do they look and feel like? And how are y'all helping?
Yeah. So just going a bit to the previous question is, when we see the evolution of the financial stack, because if I would be sitting here 5 years ago talking about a reconciliation startup, it wasn't even relevant, right? Yeah. So then the question is, why did this become a thing? And when you analyze the stack, financial services, we've seen a huge proliferation in the application layer, which has basically made the tech stack very fragmented and very modularized. Today, building a fintech is just stitching together a bunch of these providers that do very specific and niche things. And so that means that now money movement and the transactions is going through many different abstraction layers on top of what real money movement is, which is in the banks. The banks, with the account in the Fed, that's real money. Everything else is an abstraction layer built on top. And so that's when now the transaction is flowing through many different layers, is that there's a systemic risk in the industry, which comes from the inability to track the transaction end to end.
Help us understand, like, the risk that comes in there. So you're saying there's an abstraction layer and the risk is inside that abstraction layer, and kind of, yeah, why and how?
The risk is for each one of these players involved in the transaction lifecycle. Okay. It's become incredibly difficult and hard, and sometimes impossible, to actually track money movement.
Okay.
And so going back to the question on how does the day-to-day look like, let's say you're a neobank, right? And you're sitting on top of a sponsor bank. And let's just assume there's no banking as a service provider in the middle. And just to conceptualize what reconciliation is, the neobank is offering depository services and other products and services to its customers, but it's built on top of a sponsor bank, which is actually holding the money. And under these FBO structures, right? These FBO structures means that these neobanks typically have just one big cardholder pooled account in these banks. And so then they're keeping a ledger in their systems to account for the amount of money you have, the amount of money I have, and et cetera. And so basically that setup requires consistent reconciliation to make sure that whatever's happening in the software layer at the fintech layer has a real money movement that backs it.
Yeah.
Right. And so the day-to-day typically requires you having an internal file, which typically is a ledger or a backend system that's spitting out what actually all the activity in the platform, in the software platform. And then on the other hand, you have another transactional file coming from the bank. So reconciliation is always about comparing what should happen against what actually happened.
Yep. Okay.
And surfacing the differences. And so just spoiler alert, these files never match.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Just doesn't have. Is it like a joke in the industry that
they no never match 100%? And conceptually, this comes from these are different systems.
Yeah.
And they're not connected.
Fragmented. Yeah.
And so the day to day typically involves a lot of data ingestion, data parsing, and data processing. Because the other challenge with this is that these files come in many different shapes and forms, different formats, different structures, different connectors. And so there's a lot of data engineering behind this. And then some of the companies do this in Excel, Python scripts, or SQL scripts. But once you automate sort of like the comparison of these files, given they never match, where most time is spent, where most money is lost, and where most risk is created, is in the last mile, which involves investigating and closing the discrepancies.
And you've talked about like a gap in money movement that is quite valuable. I mean, I think it's like multi-million dollars. That the system isn't attending to or hasn't flagged. Can you talk us through that gap? It sounds like there's like a market opportunity there. Is that the market opportunity for Rexy, or just help us understand that piece of it there?
Well, the first part is like sort of situating ourselves in 2026 and sort of not accepting that there's leakage in the payment system, right?
Not accepting like there is, but we just don't acknowledge it.
I don't accept.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
And I want to build something that makes this 100%.
Okay.
To me, it's very mind blowing to say, I don't know, 2% of all TPV is lost. And these are just balance sheet write-offs that fintechs, payment companies, or banks are doing because they're not able to track money across all these systems or interact.
So the larger system is built on this idea that like 1% to 2% will just be written off and we all just agree and we're fine with it?
We don't know the exact values, but when we go and reconcile these systems, or when we go in and are in demos or in pilot tests with customers, we're finding that many of these companies are writing off. This is just like literally balance sheet write-off, approximately between 1% and 2% of their TPV.
Wow.
So like 1% or 2% might be a low number, but when these companies are transacting billions, this is a lot of money getting lost.
It adds up. Let's go into your product, and I want to kind of understand how you're using AI in particular to turn reconciliation from what we just said, like a cost center, to a competitive advantage. You said like 5 years ago, this wasn't a thing, now it's a thing. So tell us.
Yeah, so reconciliation is an incredibly nuanced space. It's a universe of edge cases. So that's why until today, software has been a not great solution for it, because software is by definition static. And so that's why solutions out there in the market are very expensive or are vertically focused, because they build for a specific use case and then they're very expensive because they still have to go in and adapt it to your logic, to your setup, and to your integrations. So the big tech window we're seeing with AI is, first, it's way more productive than human creating matching rules and understanding the logics behind these files. It's faster to parse through files to standardize the formats. It's faster to identify discrepancies and propose new rules. So it's just like an order of magnitude more productive.
Right.
But then it's also a business model enabler because it enables us to build a tool that's way more agnostic and way more flexible. And that basically unlocks two things in terms of the addressable market. First, we can be vertical agnostic. We can serve we can serve the banking industry, the payments industry, insurance, marketplaces, and so on.
Sure.
And we can also go to that market, which many of the existing solutions are not going because the business model is not viable. Meaning the way it's structured with a very static SaaS that they need to implement and they need to maintain, the ACV for that just outprices the mid and lower segments that cannot pay for that. So today, 80 or 90% of the ecosystem is reconciling using Excel macros, SQL queries, and a bunch of teams visually inspecting different files.
Right.
The big enterprise customers, they can pay for Blacklines, TradeTech, and so on. And they've been doing it that way. Very, very expensive solutions, but they sort of work.
So like, I think that's interesting. Like, what changes for the user, the customer, you know, on their finance teams when they use a tool like Rexy? How does that shift the day to day? And also this point about, you know, you said Rexy doesn't just match the data, it understands it. So are you giving folks like kind of a companion that they can use in the reconciliation process? Like, walk us through that on the product side.
So there's two sides to it, right? Because it depends on which type of customer we're talking about.
Right, sides, yeah.
We tend to divide the world between like, either are we targeting non-consumption or we're targeting some sort of consumption. By non-consumption, and this comes from HBS sort of framework. The non-consumption is companies that are not using any solution.
Okay.
That are just like manually using Excel macros or some sort of like bespoke internal tooling they've built to automate some parts of the process, but there's still a lot of manual and intensive labor into this workflow. Mm-hmm. In those cases, the impact typically is centered around automation.
Sure.
And sort of like a lot of manual tasks and hours that are saved because we're automating the process end to end, right? And sure. So for those teams, we are freeing a lot of time so that they can focus on higher value added tasks.
Mm-hmm. And the consumption side?
Sorry, what?
You said the consumption side? You said non-consumption and consumption.
And on the consumption side, typically they've built something that basically automates the transaction matching side of it.
Yeah.
But then they still have to manually investigate the differences. They still need to do the accounting reconciliation and so on. And so our solution basically automates the process end to end. It's not only about transaction matching, but also how can you have agents that are looking at the discrepancies and help you find the patterns. I mean, if a human today is visually inspecting the differences and finding explanations, then an agent should be able to do it. And what we're finding there is that that's how we actually reduce the write-offs.
Yeah, yeah.
Because what happens today, if you have 10,000 transactions you need to investigate and explain the difference, what are humans doing? They're sorting them. They're investigating the bigger ones, and the long tail is what they're writing off.
So are you delivering insights into the laps of the end user, into the finance teams? Is that, okay.
And the agents over time, what they're doing is they're built with context windows that learn about the business logic of that business.
Yeah. Okay.
And so once they start working on those discrepancies together, the human plus the agent, the agent basically is putting into code all the tribal knowledge that's concentrated in these people's heads because they've been doing this manually, investigating visually the files for the past 5 to 10 years.
I love that phrase you said, the universe of edge cases. Like, are you seeing then that the agents are kind of like, are they making edge cases that are taking up a lot of time and effort into a process? And they're kind of like, okay, we've seen this before. Now I can just make this much easier for myself and for my human counterpart. Like, how is that changing kind of the workflows and structures of the clients you work with?
I mean, once you configure that reconciliation workflow and something fails, a human comes in, inspects it, and then explains it.
Sure.
That is something that any AI agent can today do and do it better, faster, and increase the coverage of what you're investigating because it can run 24/7, basically.
Yep.
So that's what it's doing. And edge, when I say infinite
universe
of edge cases, of course, there's like an 80-20 there where our systems and our, and this is an interesting question around, but can these companies build something like Rexy internally or not?
Yeah, okay, interesting.
And how I answer that objection is our systems, first, we're like experts in the topic.
Sure.
So we're nerds around reconciliation.
Reconciliation nerds, yeah.
And, but the second and the technical explanation to that is that our agents are trained with a wider amount of edge cases because we're seeing everything across our portfolio of customers. Mm-hmm. So that means that when we deploy an agent for your use case, that agent is an expert in reconciliation.
Okay.
And it's very possible that all the edge cases that might surface for your use case, the agent has already seen and knows how to solve it. And this has to do with duplicates, bad transactions, a provider going on a blackout for a couple hours and then batching all those transactions there. There's a lot of nuances that can go into there.
Yeah. I want to move us from product to growth strategy. It would be remiss if we didn't talk about that. We're a growth strategy firm. I'm conscious that you use founder-led sales, do live demos, you know, real customer data. You've identified deployment speed as one of kind of the biggest current, and you've got this ambitious target, 0 to 50K MRR in 2026. So I kind of want to understand a couple of things, your plan for this year, like, you know, how's it going and what are you looking at for the rest of the year? And just what is the roadmap for scaling Rexy based on all of that I've shared?
What's for us in 2026? So we started building the company in 2025.
Okay.
I graduated from HBS in May. So we sort of like formally full-time started building a year ago. Let's say we had a sellable product by end of last year, end of 2025. So we've been like actively going to market starting this year.
Wow.
Now, of course, at the beginning, we were working with design partners that converted to paying customers. But now we're in the middle of onboarding our first big set of enterprise customers and really want to nail those. So that's in terms of what's ahead in the very, very short term. In terms of that MRR target, we're about to hit that actually.
Amazing.
In the next
wow.
couple of weeks.
Whoa, congrats.
And we're seeing a really strong pull from many different verticals and a really strong pipeline. So that acceleration, that momentum is that we are targeting to raise our seed round by Q3. So the next quarter, I think it's going to be July, September. And in terms of where to focus that seed round and why we're fundraising, it's going to be growth.
Okay.
Of course, we're going to continue to invest in product development and continue building towards our vision, which I can just come in a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
But I think the playbook is flipping around in terms of the speed that we're seeing today with product development.
Yeah.
Just makes me think that it's not a resource intensive department anymore. With the team we have right now, we have an amazing team of engineers that's very knowledgeable about this problem space. And we're building at a speed that is just...
It's insane.
It's insane. I've had customers where I show them a demo at the beginning of the month. Yeah. I show them something else at the end of the month. And they're like, what the hell is this? How does this change so quickly? So it's going to be most of that round is to accelerate distribution.
Okay.
In terms of distribution, in a world where product and technology gets commoditized, mm-hmm. the things we're going to be investing the most is creating our brand.
Yeah.
Our brand, our reputation, and that applies both for Rexy and for ourselves individually as the co-founders,
it's
going to be one of the critical assets we need to start building. Yeah,
I couldn't agree more. I mean, we see this and like we've been over-indexing on brand and we're like telling anybody who will listen, like it's going to be about brand. And like that you said it beautifully, like in a world where, you know, product and technology are commodified, like what else remains, right? It's what people think of you, how you make them feel, you know, you show up in a room of other brands, you know what I mean? How you stand out. So we've been doing a lot of work with folks on like really focus on your branding, focus on founder branding, executive branding. So couldn't agree with that more. I wanted to ask you about, you said this isn't a typical SaaS sale. You're taking over critical financial infrastructure, essentially. So like, I do founder-led sales, you do founder-led sales. What is that sale process like convincing someone, hey, we just started last year straight out of business school. I want to take over a critical part of your financial infrastructure. Trust me. Like, what does that look like when you do that?
It's a great question. And I'll tie it to the one before. Yeah. The other thing we're actively investing on is in person.
Yeah.
We're flying around for demos. We're flying around for pilots. We're flying around for implementing.
It's making a difference. Are you seeing anything?
It's making a huge difference. Yeah. Again, AI has also commoditized and made this sort of like cold outbound channel zero-sum game.
Yeah.
So how do I convince people? Showing up.
You got to get there, yeah. Yeah.
Totally. Showing up. It's all about that trust and that relationship. And it's putting yourself on the buyer's shoes. And I saw this particularly at Money 2020, which is a 25,000 people conference. And it's full of salespeople. It's actually like aggressive.
Yeah.
And when you put yourself in the shoes of the buyer, you're like...
Yeah.
There's 25 tools out there doing exactly the same thing.
And don't
even get started talking about why you're different in terms of product and technology.
Right.
Because we all know that's crap or that it's marginal.
Yeah.
And when you think about the gap versus what they have today, they don't care if it's 3x or 3.1x. It's 3x.
Right.
And so who are they buying from? They're buying from the reputable brand and the person which they trust.
Yeah.
And so for that, we're investing a lot in, again, flying around to be in person for as many interactions as we can, and then conferences.
Yeah.
And just to note on that one, I think it's not those huge conferences.
Even if you go to those, it's the one-to-ones you have there. Like I'll go to those and I'll have coffees on the side and like, I just can't do the big exhibit. Like it's just so much. You know?
And they're all salespeople. My buyers are not there.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So I'm trying to show up on the smaller ones.
Okay.
Where it's like operators just getting together and sharing notes.
Yeah.
And there's no salespeople showing up in, you know, like this middle of nowhere cities, 100 people sort of conference, but maybe you have 100 CFOs of credit unions there.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to go to those ones where I can find those honest conversations and I can show up and say, hey, this is me, this is what we're building.
It's funny you mention that because we're hearing and seeing in buildings like with our clients and partners, like it's just so much more about events, you know, experiential in person, you know, just activations and just like tactile, you know what I mean? Like we're just like, there's a shift that's happening. Yes, all the technology is going to continue to outpace us, you know, crazy, crazy pace, but people are shifting a little bit, you know what I mean? In the midst of that, which is cool to see. I want to make sure I respect your time, get you out of here, but would love to just hear real quick, you know, Bain, Bitso, you know, Rexy, like, what are some of the lessons, HBS, like what are some of the hard-won leadership lessons that you're bringing into Rexy as you scale and Yeah, where'd you get them from?
So I am very grateful for a lot of people that were mentors for me in my career so far. Mm-hmm. I've learned a lot from people. I think I tend to be like a imitation learner. Mm-hmm. I see people that I admire and I try to copy them.
Interesting.
So definitely a lot of those learned along the way, starting in NXTB Ventures actually, then Bain, then Bitso, and most recently Kamoon, HPS as well. But I think nothing prepares you to building a company, to being a founder of building a company. And so the learning I've achieved the past 12 months probably is higher than everything else combined.
Yeah.
And so it's, of course, there's learnings. Of course, there's ways of thinking and operating. There's a lot of things around culture as well.
Yeah.
I saw the culture in consulting. I saw the culture in fintech. I saw the culture at HBS. And so you try, of course, that eventually builds up who you are and how you work.
Yeah.
But then the day-to-day and all the learnings come from being in the field and taking consequential decisions on product, on team, on engineering, on fundraising, on everything.
Like you said, you know, getting your biggest insights came from getting close to the operational problems, not the abstract version, but the real messy reality. And I think it's so easy as a founder to just like, oh, I'm way up here and I'm making all these decisions. And you're just so abstracted from what's really happening. But when you actually dive in, you're like, oh, okay, this is what's happening in my own company sometimes. And it's like, yeah.
For us, that was very obvious. I mean, the three co-founders, we were operators before.
Okay.
We were really close to the reconciliation workflows and all the controls around it. Yeah. And so we're sort of like building the platform we wish we had. And then how we're building it today, again, we have a huge, and we're investing a lot in our forward deployed function. And again, we fly around, we go in person.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm flying next week to Columbus, Ohio to onboard a big payments company.
Nice.
And the first week is a full workshop, just understanding their business, their files, their needs, and creating those relationships with the people, because ultimately that's what's going to make us sort of like enable to build towards our vision.
Totally. Even in the AI era, people still buy from people. You know what I mean? And I think what I'm seeing is like people who invest in that relationship, they get on the road, they look people in the eye, they shake hands. It's going to matter even more, I think. You know what I mean? Like, I think you get the right salesperson, you get an operator who can sell. I mean, there's nothing that can stop them, you know, because they're just going to get out there and do it, and they can build, you know?
There's an issue around scalability with that business model.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, we're also investing in productizing everything we do in these implementations. We sort of like record and absorb everything we do in these 6 to 8 week implementations. Mm-hmm. To try to productize that and continue building technology that's going to give us leverage in the longer term to be more scalable.
Are you guys using any tools like Dovetail or any kind of like customer intelligence tools in the process?
Not really. Just a couple handful of tools, and then we're building a lot internally.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just shouting out a tool, but like it's a tool that allows you to kind of take in all of your sales calls, your reviews, your tickets, any customer interaction, and then turn it into a dashboard, talk to it, and then turn it into content as well. So it's insights and content. It's a powerful one that we've been trying.
Interesting.
Yeah. But also you can build a term. So cool. I want to close this out. Any last bits that you wanted to get to? Anything you wanted to call out? Any announcements? Anything?
Not really. I just want to talk a little more about our vision, which has two sides. First is our unique approach to reconciliation. And the other one is what comes after.
Yeah.
Our unique approach to reconciliation comes from our understanding of the problem.
Yep.
As I was saying before, it's a fragmented system. So the core of the problem for us is a coordination problem.
Yep.
There is a challenge around data engineering, which we are already nailing with AI, but that's not what's going to give us defensibility in the longer term.
Right.
What's going to give us defensibility in the longer term is A, what we were just talking about, brand, relationships, network, and so on, which is a critical asset we need to be building towards since day one.
Yep.
But the other one is, given our understanding that this is a coordination problem, how do we build Rexy in an interconnected way? In which what we're actually doing is solving the fragmentation problem. So imagine a world where every single party involved in the transaction flow is dumping their data in Rexy. Rexy's doing the parsing and the processing in a centralized way, and then becomes a shared collaborative platform for them to solve the discrepancies. Which I was saying before, it's where most value is going to be accrued.
Right.
Today, it's going to be humans collaborating over a central platform. Tomorrow is going to be just MCP servers and agents collaborating between each other to solve those differences. And that's when reconciliation really becomes a back office thing, something behind the scenes and a self-healing system, which is what we're pulling towards. At the end of the day, we want every single cent to be accounted for and zero leakage in the system.
I love that phrase, self-healing system. And just this whole pursuit of like making reconciliation sexy again, or for the first time ever, I don't know. But that's cool. And I think, you know, you're tackling one of the most underappreciated problems in finance and fintech, just like not just how money moves, but, you know, what happens to it. You know, if 1-2% across the board is massive, you know, that's so much value that could be captured and redistributed and given to people and to, you know, product development. And, you know,
so well, exhibit A is what happened with Synapse, right? 2024.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Which is one of the big things that made me want to start Rexy.
Okay. Interesting. So you say a little bit more about that just in case our audience isn't.
Synapse was one of the most fancy banking as a service providers that went down for other reasons. In the process of going down, they found a mismatch of records with the sponsor bank they were working with.
Yeah.
North of $160 million were lost from one day to the other.
Wow.
Those were user funds that were lost.
Wow. I mean, I think that's such a good example to build around and, you know, make a case like that those user funds, you know, and so like, this is real people's money that is just lost. And, you know, it's easy to get cynical about that stuff, but you're actually building a tool to address that and prevent it, you know, which is really good. Cool. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Ignacio. I really appreciate this conversation. You know, I think what you're building is tackling a systemic risk that's hiding in plain sight and it has implications for real people, for real people. Where can folks find out more about Rexy on the interwebs if they're interested?
Landing page, of course, rexy.finance. And then if you want to reach out via LinkedIn or email or whatever, I'm more than happy to answer any questions or doubts and do a live demo if you're interested.
Amazing. Cool. And we'll drop the links in the episode description so folks have that. And again, just thank you for joining us today. And thanks for listening, y'all. Please give us a shout, give us a 5-star rating, give us a review so we can keep bringing great guests like Ignacio Variety, the co-founder and CEO of Rexy, on the pod. Today, we're talking about rebuilding the foundation of financial operations, reconciliation specifically. And just thanks for listening, y'all. Take care. Thanks, Ignacio.
Thank you. We'll be right back.